Bien, bonsoir. Je vois que nous avons une assistance choisie. Et je vous remercie d'être venu. Même si nous parlerons à la fois de démographie et nous parlerons anglais. Il est courtois et traditionnel de présenter le professeur qui est invité par le Collège de France à présenter ses recherches. Je le fais aujourd'hui avec un enthousiasme particulier dans le cas du professeur William Youngman de l'Université de Groningen aux Pays-Bas. Parce que son ouvrage « The Economy and Society of Pompeii » paru à Amsterdam en 1988 et réédité en 1991, fut, pour l'archéologue de terrain que je suis, une incitation à mettre en perspective les données archéologiques, voire à remettre en cause les conclusions historiques qu'on pensait pouvoir en tirer. L'archéologie est d'un apport majeur à l'histoire ancienne. C'est même la seule branche où la documentation s'accroît significativement et où l'on peut désormais bâtir des séries de faits qui nous manquaient jusqu'à présent pour éclairer tel ou tel aspect, en particulier de l'évolution technique et économique. Mais cela ne peut se faire qu'à la double condition que les archéologues interprètent et datent correctement les vestiges qu'ils trouvent et qu'ils fournissent des séries d'observations suffisamment nombreuses pour gommer l'hétérogénéité d'une documentation qui sera, par nature, toujours partielle. Partielle du fait des destructions qui ont eu lieu au cours des siècles, partielle du fait de la disparition quasi générale des matières organiques, partielle aussi parce que nous ne pourrons jamais fouiller la totalité des vestiges, et heureusement d'ailleurs. Il s'agit donc d'obtenir des échantillons significatifs qui répondent à des questions historiques. À ce titre, William Youngman a forcé les archéologues à ouvrir les yeux sur nos présupposés, contestant les acquis qu'une longue tradition avait consacrés et qui se sont avérés erronés ou du moins fragiles. Il dit qu'il nous a déniaisés, ce qui est en partie vrai, mais comme nous le verrons dans le séminaire que nous ferons mardi prochain ensemble, son livre salutaire est à resituer dans le contexte historiographique de son temps. Certains points, probablement excessifs, ont fait l'objet de contestations justifiées, et surtout l'évolution des recherches archéologiques récentes a répondu à certaines de ces interrogations. Mais il demeure que le choc qu'il a provoqué n'en finit pas de nous interpeller. L'archéologue doit continuer à se dire « Que signifie ce que j'observe ? Dans quel contexte se situe mon interprétation de tel ou tel vestige ? Et surtout, comment puis-je démontrer mon interprétation du site que je dégage afin d'intégrer ces enseignements dans la trame historique ?» Après sa phase pompéienne, William Youngman a élargi son horizon, travaillant sur des données fournies par l'archéologie à une bien plus large échelle, mais toujours avec la même approche décapante et l'ambition d'embrasser les phénomènes historiques dont les vestiges témoignent par la mise en série des données. Ainsi, il a travaillé sur le peuplement et la démographie en Italie à partir des résultats des prospections archéologiques qui progressivement couvre de larges portions du territoire, donnant une image de plus en plus fiable de la densité d'occupation et surtout de son évolution. Ainsi, il a étudié l'évolution de la diète alimentaire des populations dans les provinces du nord-ouest de l'Empire romain, montrant la diversification apportée par l'arrivée des Méditerranéens, porteurs d'une culture alimentaire exigeante et complexe, et puis la réduction drastique de la variété des nourritures au cours de l'Antiquité tardive. Ainsi, il a essayé de retracer l'essor et le déclin du système économique et social de l'Antiquité en étudiant un marqueur physique du niveau de vie, l'évolution de la taille des hommes. Avec son équipe, il a mis en série des dizaines de milliers de mesures des os longs provenant des tombes antiques et il en tire une courbe dont le commentaire renouvelle les perspectives sur la croissance économique interne, c'est-à-dire la croissance per capita. Ainsi, il n'a pas eu peur d'appliquer des concepts théoriques de l'étude de l'économie moderne à ce que nous savons de l'économie antique, prenant le contre-pied du courant de pensée qui voulait qu'il fût inutile et même fondamentalement inadéquat de faire ainsi. On le voit, Wim Germain est un provocateur, au sens fort du terme, c'est-à-dire quelqu'un qui remet en cause les idées reçues pour leur substituer des explications souvent dérangeantes qui nous obligent en retour soit à reconnaître qu'il est dans le vrai, soit à affûter nos arguments pour démontrer qu'il a tort. C'est de tout cela dont il nous parlera au cours de ces 4 conférences qui se tiendront au mois de novembre. Elles porteront sur le niveau de vie des populations antiques, sur l'économie des villes, sur les fondements agricoles de la croissance et aussi, base de tout, sur le poids des hommes, c'est-à-dire la démographie, thème qu'il a choisi à juste titre pour commencer aujourd'hui.
Thank you, Jean-Pierre, for those kind words. And thank you, Collège de France, for the invitation to present my work in such a wonderful and inspiring environment. And thank you, the audience, for coming to listen to me speaking in English. It embarrasses me that my French is not any better than it is, but I think you would prefer intelligible English to unintelligible French. I'll try to speak slowly. For centuries after the Middle Ages, classical antiquity was a civilization to envy and admire. Not surprisingly, this faded with the Industrial Revolution, when modern society began to make a clear break with the past. That loss of admiration is reflected in 20th century histories of antiquity, where the otherness and underdevelopment of antiquity were now increasingly emphasized. Research focused on potential social and cultural explanations of ancient economic failure and largely avoided to document actual economic performance. We already knew it was a failure. Probably because at the time, no one could imagine how this was to be done. I couldn't. In the absence of sufficient documentary sources of the kind that we now that we have for later periods of history. In these 4 lectures, I will try to show that, largely thanks to the tremendous growth of archaeological information during the recent decades, we are now in a position to reassess Roman economic performance directly and in part show why I was wrong earlier on. There are now plenty of data, and the challenge is to use them imaginatively. And unlike in the past, when data were few and far between, this new challenge involves dealing with an embarrassment of riches. We need to find methodologies to aggregate these data if we want to write big history in an empirical way, rather than just by summarizing books in the library. Where indeed in world history does classical antiquity stand, and ancient Rome in particular? Now, as the novelist L.P. Hardley wrote, the past is a foreign country. They do things differently there. End quote. And if there is one thing different in the past, and more so the further back into the past we look, it is human number. There are far more people living now than ever before, and world population is still growing rapidly. On the one hand, that is a problem because it increases demand for scarce resources, and these days poses a real threat of environmental Armageddon. But on the other hand, it offers many opportunities. In the past, it meant a populous state could have a bigger army and hence dominate others. These days, that aggregate power is more economic. A bigger population also allows for more complex social organization, more division of labor, and more smart people to invent new technologies, or more astrophysicists historians or top artists. More people also implies that either mortality went down or that parents were optimistic enough to have more children. So by and large, more people is a sign that things are going well, even if population pressure creates its own problems and potentially even disastrous ones. Now, I want to begin my analysis of Roman population history by first taking a step back, however, to review the world's population history since the last ice age and the first beginnings of agriculture some 15,000 years ago. This is the slide of the McEverdy and Jones estimates for the history of world population. Picture from Wikipedia. One thing is immediately obvious, and of course you already know this. The big jump in world population is a relatively recent one and roughly coincided with the Industrial Revolution. Before that, population growth was much slower, and by the look of this graph, almost non-existent. That, however, is somewhat misleading, as the picture is so overshadowed by recent population growth. We have a scale problem that blinds our vision. To overcome this, we can graph the same data on a so-called semi-log scale, semi-logarithmic scale, where population is pictured on a logarithmic scale on the vertical axis, and time is still, of course, pictured on a linear scale. Same data. Such a semi-log scale has one very useful property, and that is that the same growth rate, i.e. percentage growth, is represented by the same slope of the curve. If the percentage growth is always the same, you would have a straight line from the origin going up. Now that you know this, you can observe that recent population growth was not only largest in absolute numbers, as you could see in the first graph, but also had the bigger growth rate ever. And again, you can see that the last two centuries or so mark a clear turning point in human history. The potential for disaster is obvious, but the origin is a happy one. From sometime in the 19th century, we've started to live longer, first in northwestern Europe, and increasingly also elsewhere. In pre-industrial Europe, average life expectancy had been some 30 years, or even rather less in unhealthy environments like cities. The big killers had been infectious diseases, often killing half a birth cohort before the age of 10. In the 19th century, this started to change, with life expectancy at birth of some 60 years in more favorable conditions. Think of the sanitation measurements in London or Haussmann's changes here in Paris. In turn, the 20th century added quite a few more years again, to the extent that some demographers predict that of the current birth cohort, about half will reach the age of 100, and even in relatively good condition. So the past was indeed a foreign country. This shows the age-specific incidence of death in the modern world. And you can see it takes a long time for the cohorts to get a bit smaller. And most people, an extraordinarily large proportion, sort of 90%, reaches about 60 or so. So death at an early age is a rare phenomenon. We're not really used to it anymore. And then most people die sort of in the same age bracket. That's the modern world. It's a happy one. Now, this is roughly what you would expect for the pre-industrial world to apply, with sort of upper margins and lower margins. What you can see is that within the first 5 years, close to half the age cohort dies. It's infant mortality, and it's horrific. And but even thereafter, death remains important. I always tell my students, if I want to explain to them what a pre-industrial mortality pattern looks like, that 1 in 9 of them wouldn't finish for their degree because they would have died beforehand if this kind of mortality pattern applied to them. Okay. Back to the earlier slide now. It's now time to investigate the rest of the slide for the rest of the demographic story of civilization. What it shows is that population growth is not a uniquely modern thing, even if modern population growth is indeed unprecedented. From the very first beginnings of early agriculture, world population shows an upward trend. Several estimates put world population around 1700 at 600 million, or a bit more. Now, that is 150 times more than the 4 million inhabitants estimated by McCafferty and Jones for 10,000 BC, which is what is shown on the screen. Of course, estimates of such early periods are very insecure, but for now they're good enough to show that the history of civilization is the history of slow population growth with all its challenges and opportunities. A closer inspection of the graph suggests that population growth was very slow indeed for the first millennia of settled agriculture and only started to grow with the expansion of agriculture into Europe and the rise of early states in the Levant. Both seem plausible enough and are attested archaeologically. The next rise then occurs during the first millennium BC, creating some kind of elevated plateau, founded on the success of state formation in China, the Levant, and around the Mediterranean, for what these numbers are worth, of course. And this, of course, has taken us to the classical world, and ancient Rome in particular. McCafferty and Jones, whose estimates are the source of the graphs, estimated world population at the beginning of the modern era at 170 million, of which 55 to 60 million is attributed to the Roman Empire, and a similar or slightly smaller number to that other large empire, Han China. So interestingly, in this analysis, about two-thirds of the world's population at the time was living in those two large empires of somewhat similar size, flourishing during roughly the same period of the last 2 centuries BC and the first 2 centuries AD. Now, the question, of course, is how reliable are these estimates? For the Roman Empire, they go back more than a century to the work of the great German demographic historian Carl Julius Beloch. His problem was, and our problem still is, that there's not much to work with. We just do not have the modern style census data for a robust population history of the Roman Empire. Now, this is not because the Romans didn't count their population. Read the New Testament. They did. But because almost none of the results have survived. The largest exception is the census of Italy for the period 225 BC to 28 BC. And that is the basis for Beloch's reconstruction, first of the Italian population and then of that of the empire. Every 5 years, or roughly 5 years, during the lustrum, two highest magistrates, the censors, were elected to inter alia hold a census of all male citizens of military age and of the value of their property. The latter was important because the richer you were, the more political rights you enjoyed. As for the census part, The crucial problem is that it was not a population census, but a census of citizen soldiers. So to reconstruct population totals, we have to add those Italians who were not citizens because they were slaves or because they were free allies. And we have to add those who were not of military age, and all women. And this is precisely where it gets confusing. Over time, the number of people counted in the census increases quite a bit. And that is not surprising. More and more Italians received Roman citizenship. So we have to add fewer and fewer non-citizens to have a population number rather than a citizen number. On the other hand, the number of slaves increased considerably over the same period. However, we do not know by how many. As we shall see later, recent research tends to play down rural slavery and emphasizes the growth of urban slavery. The extension of citizenship to other free Italians must be the explanation for the subsequent jump in the numbers from 86-85 BC and 70-69 BC. Then suddenly, in those two censuses, you see quite a big jump. By the latter date, the number had roughly doubled compared to the last preceding census, 425-124. The jump is not that hard to explain, fortunately. In 88 BC, Rome had won a bloody war with its Italian allies. It had defeated them, but had to offer them what they wanted, citizenship. Suddenly, therefore, there were far more citizens. The next jump in the number is in the census for 28 BC, when the number more or less quadruples, and that is much harder to explain and has been the origin of an already century-old controversy. Bailoch concluded that the sudden jump was simply too large and could not represent something real. If it were real, Italy's population would have grown dramatically, and that he didn't believe. His conclusion was that the system of the census count itself must have changed. No longer it was just citizens of military age who were counted, but also women and some children. The result, therefore, is then a much lower population total. So we have two competing reconstructions, mutually exclusive. The so-called low count, represented in recent research by Peter Brandt and Keith Hopkins, but built on Bailoch, with the free plus slave population of some 3.5 to 5 million in 225 BC, and of 5 to 6 million in 28 BC, and a so-called high count, with perhaps 4 million in 225 BC, i.e. roughly the same, but the staggering 10 million citizens plus a few million slaves in 28 BC, represented in recent research by my friend Elio Locascio from Rome. A century of scholarly ingenuity has failed to produce a conclusive argument. The high count interpretation most closely follows the sources, but its critics argue that Italy could simply not have sustained such a large population, larger than even in later pre-industrial times. Adherents of the high count interpretation counter this with the argument that it's hard to imagine that Italy's population remained more or less stable precisely when Rome conquered a world empire and amassed enormous wealth. And their other argument, of course, is, well, it's simply that's what's in the sources. What's clear, of course, is that these two interpretations of Italy's demographic history also represent two diametrically opposed reconstructions of its economic history, one optimistic and one pessimistic. So how do we decide? This example serves to illustrate the great difficulties we have to reconstruct population trends. A century of ingenious arguments by some of the best scholars in the field has failed to produce a decisive conclusion, not even for two centuries of Italian demographic history. And for the centuries before and after, these data leave us completely in the dark. And yet, these disputed estimates for 200 years of Italian population history have been the most solid part of existing reconstructions of the empire's population history. Now, these difficulties are well illustrated by the case of Roman Egypt, the other region that has enjoyed extensive discussion and had some census data, with the recent work by Renz Dacoma, Walter Scheidel, and Dominic Rathbone in particular. We have two figures from literary sources. Flavius Josephus mentions a figure of 7.5 million outside Alexandria, while Diodorus Siculus speaks of 3 million. I guess this serves to show the limitations of literary sources for economic history. It's tough. Two interesting alternative tactics were therefore used by Walter Scheidel recently. One was to look for 19th century figures from the period just before Egypt began to modernize. And it's the kind of tactic that I've also used in my work on Pompeii years ago. The problem with such figures, however, is that these sort of somewhat modern figures begin to appear precisely because modernization was setting in, and they were a product of the modernization, and you don't quite know where in that change to the modern world your data should be located. So do they really reflect a pre-modern situation? And even if they do, they only represent a possible population level, but not necessarily a probable one. The same applies to the other research tactic of calculating so-called carrying capacity. Done that too. Here, the quantity and quality of the land is analyzed, and its productive capacity. The next step is usually to calculate how much wheat could be produced and how many people this wheat could feed at subsistence. Now, there are two problems with this approach. The first is that no society will risk living at the very margin of what was possible. Yields vary considerably from one year to the next, and it's unwise to count on only good harvests or even on average harvests. You want to survive the worst years. The second problem is that such carrying capacity calculations ignore the potential for agricultural intensification and innovation. Calculating with just wheat is a gross simplification. As we shall see in the last lecture, with horticulture and viticulture, far more calories can be produced per hectare than with just cereals, even if such crops were more labor intensive. In short, carrying capacity is only a meaningful number under the assumption of unchanging agricultural practices and technologies and unchanging crop choice. Zero technological change. If and when farmers took up the challenge, they could produce far more. Therefore, for example, Bailo's argument, remember, that Italy could simply not have sustained the population that is implied by the high count, is simply untenable. It could, if it needed and wanted to. Which is, of course, not the same as saying that it did. But that's a story for the last lecture. Finally, and related, is the failure to account for changes over time. Comparative data, carrying capacity, or a few numbers from literary sources almost invariably give us an estimate for one moment in time. Of course, such estimates, suspended in a timeless and static universe, fitted nicely with the pessimistic reconstruction of a pre-industrial longue durée of life at or near subsistence that was popular in the later 20th century. In ancient history, for example, it allowed my old teacher Moses Finley to present a structural analysis of the ancient economy, freely mixing anecdotes from archaic Greece, Republican Rome, or late antiquity into one account of a society where little ever changed. But was that really true? And more interestingly and importantly, of course, can we find out? As we've seen in the very long run, it was certainly not true. But how about a shorter time frame of individual civilizations, and ancient Rome in our case? Now, if you ask any field archaeologist, you will get an answer that clearly conflicts with ancient historians' account of a static economy. They will tell you that Roman levels are far richer than those that come before and after, and that also, even within the Roman period, there are significant differences over time. There is real history of change. Here, the big breakthrough has been the hard work on rural field surveys of the last few decades. Let me first briefly explain for those who are unfamiliar with the method. The purpose is to reconstruct patterns of past habitation by collecting small surface finds in a systematic way. This is how it looks like. The students as slave labor. Each year, ancient chariots are ploughed to the surface, and each year, other chariots are ploughed under. But on the surface, there is almost always a fair amount of ancient chariots, and more so when habitation was more intense. You notice when you walk through the field, suddenly there is a lot more of this junk in the field. So if you plot these chariots, we can see concentrations, or even very large concentrations. Since these chariots can also be dated, these distribution maps can give us a number of time slices of habitation patterns, small farms, large farms, villas, or even villages for really large concentrations of chariots. And all datable, so you can see changes over time. Obviously, larger sites like villas are much easier to find than small farms or seasonal dwellings. So survey methods have become increasingly intensive to make sure that the recovered size distributions represent past reality. We do not want to miss the small farms and conclude there were only big landowners. With such increased intensity of modern surveys, their extent has obviously been reduced, which has induced archaeologists to devise smart sampling strategies. You can't really survey a whole region anymore. You have to do small plots here and bits there and there, and you have to think carefully to create a representative sample. So altogether, we have some 24 surveys for Italy alone, and at least 100 for the empire at large. The bad news is that archaeologists are intelligent people, who often feel that they can develop methodologies that are better than those of others. Also, many of the underlying data are not available in open access. Archaeologists are very possessive about their data. As a result, the many thousands of man-years, and it's really been an enormous effort over the last few decades, that have gone into these surveys have not quite made it into the historical reconstruction. To change this, three teams working around Rome, our own Groningen team, working the Pontine Region project, working in the south, the Suburbium team of La Sapienza, working in the immediate environment of Rome, and the Tiber Valley project of the British school at Rome, the successor to the original South Etruria survey, the mother of all surveys. These three projects have now joined forces to integrate their data sets. And once successful, to extend this in a big way, first we hope in Italy, but then also we hope in other parts of the empire. We'd love to have some French data at some stage in the future. France matters. This is important because already now it's obvious that many Italian surveys show quite similar patterns of demographic growth and subsequent contraction, as was already observed by Alessandro Lonaro and Mamoru Ikeguchi. To show you in more detail what is possible, I present here the demographic reconstructions for the Albania Valley by Lisa Fentress and the Nettuno region by the Groningen team of Timon de Haas, Gijs Tol and Peter Atema, using Lisa Fentress methodology. So you have the red one is the Nettuno graph, and the grey one here is the Albania graph. Okay, so what they did was they assigned a notional population number to each site category. So, for example, 5 people for a farm, 20 for a villa, 200 or so for a village. I don't quite remember, but that's the idea. And then multiply that by the number of sites in that particular category. The result is a total population number for each period. Now, I've plotted the results in one graph, and as you can see, the patterns are not only remarkably similar, but they also show a clear pattern of significant population growth in the Republican period, followed by a quite dramatic decline. That's a story of decline and fall. As a historian, I would like a more precise chronology. We always want more. But this is what it is, given our dependence on the chronologies of diagnostic pottery. For a historian, it's also quite obvious that these two surveys tell a story that is significantly different from the traditional historical accounts of a world without change or of a world of decline of Italian agriculture in the Republican period. If you've read your Appian or Plutarch. Here, the landscape filled up from sometime in the late 4th or early 3rd century, reached a plateau sometime in the early imperial period, to become empty again in late antiquity. And it's a pattern that's not unique to these two exceptionally well-researched areas. Almost all Italian surveys show a picture of significant growth followed by dramatic decline, even if for those surveys we only have site numbers rather than reconstructed population numbers. The trend is quite similar. Yet this is also the moment to insert 2 notes of caution with regard to the absolute numbers in these reconstructions. The first is that the archaeologists cannot know if they've found all sites. Some smaller sites are likely to have passed unnoticed, even in the most intensive survey. But that's why you do an intensive survey. On the other hand, precisely those small sites do not contribute that much to population totals, precisely because they're so small. The second note of caution obviously concerns the notional numbers of people per site type in these estimates. Is 20 for a villa a good number? They're reasonable guesses by well-respected field archaeologists, but no more than that. They're not facts. Hence, the absolute population numbers in these reconstructions are quite speculative, even if the shape of the trend is not. Historically, I think this represents a major advance because the shape of that trend is what interests us most. What's that change? And what kind of change? Of course, some historians have argued that the Italian boom was the product of Roman imperialism. We're quite happy these days to assign all sorts of horrible intentions and behavior to the Romans, and at the expense of conquered provinces. For that, we therefore have to look at provincial data. Did provincial population decline because of Roman rapacity, or did it boom as a result of inclusion in a larger political and economic unit with its more advanced core? To answer this question properly, we shall have to look at provincial surveys. Here, the historical interpretation has only just begun, but I want to show you two graphs for illustration and as a reminder of the analytical potential of this kind of data. The first is a graph from a forthcoming article by Xavier Derue. It contains curves for site numbers from a range of areas in the northeast of France and neighboring parts of Germany. The clever thing, and it's really clever, it's very simple but it's clever, is that these are graphs of index numbers, with 100 for the period with the largest number of sites. This makes the curves comparable, without indulging in very fancy econometrics. So we can compare the shape of these curves and we compare the points where they reach their maximum. The image is, I think, very convincing. You can see that sort of the boom is later than in Roman Italy, because obviously they had to wait for the Romans to arrive and sort of make everybody happy. The final graph that I want to show you is a somewhat different one by Andreas Zimmermann and his team in Cologne. Data are from the large-scale surface excavations in the brown coal area west of Bonn and Cologne. Enormous surface excavations, therefore extremely detailed. The cost was enormous, but it was paid for by the industry. So, hey, have a go at it, archaeologists. This is heaven. So they have the same amazing detail that you in France know from the TGV trajectory in the Rhone Valley or from the Canal du Nord. Quite simply, there are no better data. And this allowed Zimmermann to produce precise demographic estimates for the entire period from the early Neolithic to the recent past. You can also see, of course, that the chronological resolution is only coarse, and unnecessarily so, because the data allow much greater chronological precision. I've asked Andreas, will you please, please, please subdivide this properly, because it will make me so happy, and I'm hoping he'll do it. You have the dark grey, which is the minimum estimate, and on top of that, there is the sort of the margin of error, and here, this is the maximum estimate, and somewhere, sort of truth is somewhere in between. We don't know precisely where, but this is roughly it. The beauty of these data, of course, is the very long time perspective. This is the longue durée in its ultimate incarnation. What we see is a slow but steady rise until Roman times, when population exploded, followed by an even more dramatic decline and fall. Just imagine. I mean, in the Merovingian time, nobody lives there anymore. And you can see it from the archaeobotanical data as well. I mean, just the forest comes back. Just nothing happening there anymore. I know of no other graph to argue as convincingly that Roman history actually matters. At the same time, we must acknowledge that the best survey data are from the western part of the empire and do not necessarily represent the full story, and in particular not the full story of decline. As you know, the Eastern Empire did not go down like the Western, even if it also experienced many problems in the 3rd century AD. So the picture may well be far more varied, and a comparative analysis of demographic trends between regions is an urgent research priority. hence my interest in these survey integration projects. We need more data, and preferably really nice and hard ones. Now, this, of course, invites the question how and why. In a stable population, the number of births is equal to the number of deaths. But in a growing population, this is not so. More people are born each year than are dying each year. Hence, the population is growing. Think of it as a bath. There is a tap with new water that comes into the bath, that's birth, and there is a drain where people go down. So if the tap is more water coming into the tap than there is water going out of the bath through the drain, the level in the bath will rise, or the other way around. Demography is simple. But which of the two has changed, birth rate or death rate? In the earlier example of the population explosion after the Industrial Revolution, it was primarily the death rate that changed. We simply lived longer. People had discovered the basic mechanism of infectious disease and had taken measures to reduce it. Hence, life expectancy at birth had improved dramatically. So the question, of course, is, did the same happen in ancient Rome? Did advances in ancient medicine, we read all these famous medical authors, and improvements in sanitation improve life expectancy? Or, if not, did population grow because people were optimistic about the future and decided to have more children? Did people have more children because, as Pliny the Younger says in his panegyric on Trajan, they were so pleased with his rule that they decided to have more children? Conversely, did late antique population decline because people decided to have fewer children or because of a higher death rate? Changes in the birth rate are hard to reconstruct in the absence of surviving records. But we can try if we can say something about the death rate and life expectancy in particular. The subject's importance is obvious. We all want to live long and healthy lives. And if society fails in this respect, it's a big failure indeed. But how can we reconstruct life expectancy? The oldest attempts use surviving funerary inscriptions. You look at lots and lots of tombstones, and we have plenty of them from the Roman period, and quite a few of them have ages. So you just put all those together. Hard work, but now, that was how it used to be done, until in 1966, a young, energetic, clever Keith Hopkins published a famous article in Population Studies. He compared the age-specific incidence of death as found in the funerary inscriptions with what we know from other better documented pre-industrial societies using so-called model life tables produced by the United Nations. By now, you would use the better Princeton tables, but he didn't have those yet at the time. His conclusion was clear. The mortality pattern in these inscriptions is simply demographically impossible. Collecting ages at death from tombstones is a waste of time for demography. These ages on tombstones represent commemoration rather than mortality. Some age groups are very sad, like sort of girls who die on the wedding night when they're 14 years old. That really merits an inscription, but it's because it's sad. Now, culturally, these differences are interesting, and they really still merit some more research. But they fatally undermine the demographic value of these data. Hopkins' innovation had replaced defective and misleading ancient data by an estimate based on better documented comparative data. Justification was that even if life expectancy is unknown, the age-specific incidence of death at a particular level of life expectancy follows a pretty predictable pattern. Based on comparative evidence, Hopkins and later others as well have assumed that Roman life expectancy at birth varied between about 25 years and 35 years, or sometimes even lower. This is roughly in line with other pre-industrial societies. But it's a circular argument, of course. Anyway, this is, you've already seen it, this is what it, 30 years, this is 25 years, this is what 25 years looks like, this is the upper band and this is the lower band. And this is from one of these model life tables. And there's also this one, and that represents Essex around 1800. You can see that already in England, before the actual Industrial Revolution, people were living better. But that's an exception. The Brits were very lucky. As you can see, the highest mortality was with young children who were particularly vulnerable to infectious disease, to bad feeding habits. This pattern from comparative research has been confirmed by a few other studies that used isolated ancient data sets. The most important was the study of the demography of Roman Egypt by Bagnall and Fryer, based on some surviving census data on papyrus preserved in the dry sand of the desert. Their conclusion, after much soul searching and careful correction of the data, was that these census returns roughly conform to model life tables with a life expectancy at birth in the range about 22.5 years to 25 years, i.e. at the very lower possible level where the population could still have reproduced itself. It couldn't really be any worse than this. Roman Egypt was not a healthy place. More recently, Walter Scheidel has looked into the Egyptian census data again and is rather more skeptical than Bagnall and Fryer. He concludes that the data are probably irredeemably biased by underreporting, particularly in rural districts. After all, these records were produced to facilitate taxation. Not everybody is happy to pay taxes. Scheidel's most positive contribution is that the census data show a significantly higher mortality in urban areas compared to rural districts. Historically, this is important because it confirms the generally held view that pre-industrial cities were demographic black holes with a mortality that far exceeded natality, for the simple reason that both airborne and waterborne infectious would thrive in an environment with high population density. It's people who kill other people with their infections. Urban life may have been conducive to economic growth and cultural efflorescence. It was not healthy. Apart from modern life tables and Egyptian census records, we also have one elementary ancient life table, the so-called Ulpian's life table, and an inscription from a funerary collegium with both the payout at death and the annual contribution rate, and thus an implied remaining life expectancy. With all their imperfections, these two data sets also draw a pretty bleak picture of high mortality and low life expectancy. Finally, there's another fascinating piece of research by Walter Scheidel on the ages of death of Roman emperors who died a natural death. Yes, there were some of those. His conclusion was that emperors too suffered from high levels of mortality that corresponded to life expectancy at birth of 30 to 35 years, i.e. hardly better than what has been estimated for the population at large. Death was democratic. And that is not surprising for rulers who lived in the disease capital of the world. They had it coming. Now, this leaves one more type of data before we try to make any sense of the picture. Skeletons. What better evidence of death than dead bodies, you would think. And all the more so since there are more than enough remaining skeletons. Next week, I will tell you more about a project in which I participate, and that involves a skeletal data set of 10,000 quite well-studied individuals and many more bones. Sadly, and even though skeletons are often used for demographic reconstructions, aging them is actually a daunting task in the case of adults. Children's skeletons change, and therefore you can age them quite well. But once you're fully grown, not much happens anymore. So there is little or no difference between a 25-year-old and a 50-year-old. To be honest, and to offer a bit of nuance to this pessimism, recent research by Esther Laser on skeletons from Pompeii and Herculaneum indicates the presence of quite a few skeletons with diseases and wear typical of old age. So here at least, you have to be old to get these diseases. So here at least, a fair number may have survived into more advanced years. Although we should be aware of the particular nature of the sample. Survivors of the catastrophe may well have been rather younger. It's the young who could run away. So what conclusions can we draw about life expectancy in Rome, given the problematic state of the data? The first is that the data themselves are bad. There's no way around this. And that even though the last few decades have seen very ingenious research, that research has mostly served to underscore how little solid data we have. And we've been pretty good at destroying everything that we thought we had. At the same time, there is a reassuring convergence between the comparative information and the little that we have from ancient written data. We have to assume that mortality was high, particularly in infants, and life expectancy was quite low, in the range perhaps 25 to 35 years, with probably quite a bit of variation around this. Urban mortality, for example, is likely to have been rather higher, as we shall also discuss in the third lecture. For the future, I think there is little prospect that we will be able to improve on these estimates, let alone that we can further differentiate them either chronologically or regionally. Life tables simply need large numbers of data, and that's precisely the problem. Where I believe we can make some real progress is in the study of health and disease. Why did so many people die at such an early age? And what was the quality of their lives? Already some time ago, it's been shown by Robert Solaris and others that malaria was an important killer in central Italy and probably also elsewhere. Here, funeral inscriptions were useful, showing a seasonal pattern of mortality with a major peak in the late summer, as in early modern times. And here, obviously, commemoration doesn't come into the story. On top of that, there is now proper biomolecular evidence for the presence of malaria. Malaria was particularly lethal to those who had not yet had a chance to develop at least some immunity, such as recent rural migrants to the cities. They came in without any protection. Hence the so-called urban death trap could be even more lethal. And we shall return to this in the third lecture again. Skeletons can also show the symptoms of stress and abuse, and so-called criba orbitalia, little lesions on the front of the skull, indicated dietary deficiency from anemia, but increasingly likely also from other causes. Years ago, in a memorably revolting article, Alex Scobie documented the filth of unhygienic conditions in daily life in Rome as seen in the written source. It's a well-known article, and everyone who knows it will agree with me, it's revolting. A recent scientific article by Piers Mitchell documents the increased presence of human parasites in the Roman world as a consequence of imperial conquest, worms. We may admire Roman bath, sanitation and water supply, but these clearly did little to stem the flood of intestinal worms and other parasites spread by contamination from feces. Also, eating fish sauce made from raw fish didn't help either. It's very bad for your, in terms of intestinal infections. I know Jean-Pierre is interested in this. What we are witnessing here is the beginning of a wave of new research based on the natural sciences. Rather than pain ourselves about ancient literary descriptions of diseases, we're beginning to study the actual physical traces of those diseases. This is really the cutting edge, the new frontier, I think, in archaeology. This far, the picture is not a very cheerful one. Romans suffered from a multitude of infectious diseases and from diseases that may not have killed them, but certainly made their lives miserable. And by and large, and for all their technical ingenuity, they had no idea of the causes and hence little in the way of effective preventative prevention or therapy. To finish this grim account of disease, there is also the subject of epidemics. The empire's demographic decline is spiked by three major epidemics: the so-called Antonine Plague, probably smallpox from AD 166, the so-called Plague of Saint Cyprian from about 249 to 270, and recently studied by Kyle Harper in the Journal of Roman Archaeology, and is yet to be securely identified, and the Plague of Justinian from AD 541, and now securely identified as the real Yersinia pestis, bubonic plague, and studied extensively by Mike McCormick in a range of different publications. Each of these plagues seems to have killed large proportions of the population, and probably of the urban population in particular, say anywhere between a quarter and a half. So how did Roman society cope, or did it? So, finally, let's pull the two threads of today's lecture together. On the one hand, we have seen convincing evidence for significant population growth in the Republican period and after the conquest of provinces, also in many of those provinces, leading to pretty high population densities, and then a similarly steep decline, certainly in the 3rd century AD, but starting perhaps or probably even earlier. The second thread was that of a relatively low life expectancy, probably especially in the empire's many cities, and a variety of unpleasant health problems and diseases. So for now, I think the tentative conclusion must be that the population growth is unlikely to have been the product of a decline in mortality. So by default, this suggests that the birth rate may well have gone up, even if we can't document it. Why were people more optimistic? Come back next week. Thank you.